Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 389. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm joined today by a wonderful guest we have with us, Joe Rigney, who is the author of The Things of Earth, Treasuring God by Enjoying His Gifts. Welcome to the program, Joe. It's good to have you today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joe is the Assistant Professor of Theology and Christian Worldview at Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's the author of several books, the one we're talking about today, as well as Live Like a Narnian, Christian Discipleship in Lewis's Chronicles. And we're going to talk to him today about this new book from Crossway. But before we do so, I want to get into some news and let you know that we have our 2015 Theology Conference coming up here October 16th through 18th in Grays Lake, Illinois. We also are encouraging more and more people to sign up for that. We only have 100 spots. It's like a micro conference. And we're doing that intentionally so that you have opportunity to spend time with our speakers and all of our Reform Forum contributors that will be in attendance. Our plenary speakers will be Dr. Richard Gaffin and Dr. Lane G. Tipton. So we're excited to have them speak about the Spirit and the Church. That's October 16th through 18th, but you can register now online at reformedforum.org/conference. I also encourage you to visit us on the website as well, reformforum.org/donate, to pledge your support. We have so many great interviews and episodes lined up, including the one today, but we continue to need your support in order to be able to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. And we love recording them and we love distributing them, but we need your help. And we also would like to enter into a new phase or a new leg of our ministry and try to get some audio engineering help and some editing help, but to do that, we need your support. So once again, visit us online today at reformforum.org/donate to pledge your support. And Joe, we're getting right into it today. This is an intimate conversation just between me and you, and we of course met recently at the Gospel Coalition Conference just a few months ago. Did you have a good time there, getting around to all the different sessions?
Yeah, I did. It was good. I got to see a couple folks that I don't get to see all that often, and thought I went to a handful of the sessions and had one of my own. So all of those were good.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do? Give an address on?
So it was on the book. It was basically the 45-minute version of the book.
Yeah. So we're hopefully can get at things from a little bit different angle today, and not just repeat your address, because I assume it's available online as well as many of the other audio recordings are. So we'll put a link to that in our episode description so people can certainly follow up. But did you receive some good feedback on the book as well as the address at the conference?
Yeah, so far it's been well received. There's been a handful of reviews here and there, Gospel Coalition, other places. And I've been encouraged that at least some people, not a lot, but not all of the ones I assume who are being helped are going to tell me about it, but most people who have communicated have said that it kind of was paradigm shifting a little bit in terms of identifying with the kind of struggle that prompted me to write the book, and that it kind of cut a way forward for them to really enjoy God's creation in a way that honors it.
Yeah, I really appreciated receiving this book. Crossway sent me a copy. I think it was at your behest, but I appreciate it very much, and I've been working through the book, and I think it is a needed book. I haven't seen any other books quite like this, and I want to get into your foreword and the introduction just to set the stage for the book and why you believe it's needed, and I agree with you. But a lot of it here is just right in the title, The Things of Earth, and then the subtitle, Treasuring God by Enjoying His Gifts. Right off the bat, you begin by speaking about this war of hymns. Can you describe that tension that you find between these two very well-known hymns and how that plays out in the book?
So the two hymns I mentioned are Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus, by Babcock, I think, or Lemmel, that's Lemmel, and then Babcock's hymn, This Is My Father's World, and which are two hymns that I think, you know, growing up in church, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church, and remember singing those songs here and there, and didn't really recognize the tension. I don't think I was thoughtful enough to recognize the tension until much later, as I got into some ministry and theology and things like that. But the basic tension is in Turn Your Eyes Upon Jesus, you have this line where turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. And so it makes it sound like when Jesus shows up, the things of earth, and the question is, what is that referring to?
Right.
The things of earth grow dim, dull, dusty. They lose their luster. They're not as attractive because Jesus is here now, and he's better. And I think, okay, that's true. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But then I go over to This Is My Father's World, and I hear he shines in all that's fair. In the rustling grass, I hear him pass. He speaks to me everywhere. So on the one hand, I've got things of earth growing dim and dull. On the other hand, I've got Jesus shining in all the fair things in the world, whether it's the grass, whether it's the sky, whether it's family and friends. And so that's kind of the tension, is we know as Christians that we're supposed to honor God and glorify God. Whatever you do, whether you eat and drink, do all the glory of God. We want to live God-centered lives. And yet we're surrounded on every side by things that aren't God, that constantly vie for our attention, our affections, and which quite frankly are really enjoyable. Like they're really great things. And so, what are we supposed to do with them? And more importantly, how do they relate when Jesus shows up? What happens to the things of earth? Which I'm, obviously in the title, I'm playing a little bit on the ambiguity of that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that when Limmel wrote her hymn, she means something like things of the world, worldly things, sinful things, which is that shows up in the Bible, that way of talking.
Mm-hmm.
But the ambiguity is such that she could mean not just sinful things and worldly things. She could just mean things, right? So your food, and it's a beautiful summer day here in Minneapolis, and so this beautiful summer day is a thing of earth. What happens to it when Jesus shows up? That's the sort of tension in our songs that I'm trying to identify, and I started there because I thought people would be able to latch on to that and say, yeah, that I felt some of that.
You know, you bring up some not merely hymns that bring up that tension, but also scriptural texts. One big one that I thought of, and you include here as a foundational one, is Colossians 3:1-4. I'll read that for the listeners. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Now, of course, that's true. We must do that. But also, God created the world, and he made all things good. And then in 1 Timothy 4:4-5, Paul writes, "For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, for it is made holy by the word of God and prayer." So on the one hand, we have Christ who is better, and Christ whom we should seek, and Christ whom we should live our life for, but we also have the things of earth, and often those are played off as opposing one another, and they can certainly be, and many times they are, but must there be a dichotomy between choosing one or the other? And that seems to be what we want to wrestle with as we look through this book. One foundational element to your approach to the subject certainly begins with Edwards. You also speak about C.S. Lewis, but I want to start with your influence by John Piper, especially his approach to the Christian life, which he has termed Christian hedonism. Would you mind unpacking that for our listeners? No doubt many of them will be very familiar, but I think rehearsing the basic structure of it and the argument would be helpful for people.
Yeah, so I got to know the writings of John Piper when I was in college, like many people did, kind of back in 2001-ish. So kind of right in the Passion, the prime Passion moment. I'm sure the Passion moment's still going on, but I'm a little older now and have less hair. So, but back then that was the big thing, and it really met me. God met me in and through John's preaching and teaching and books and so forth. And so basically I went all in, not because it was particularly from Piper, but because it resonated with where I already was from reading my Bible. So, Christian hedonism, God is most glorified in me when I am most satisfied in him, so that my pursuit of joy and God's pursuit of glory are not at odds. They're one pursuit. I glorify him by enjoying him. And, So, you know, some baseline things like all men seek happiness all the time, and I knew that was true from experience. Our highest joy, our highest happiness ought to be in God. I knew that from the Bible. And then what John connected was, and this is what it means to glorify God. This is the heart of it, which the head and your heart together glorifying God by your enjoyment. So I went all in in college and said, yes, that's exactly what I see in the scriptures. That's what I want my life to be built on. And so went through college and then moved up here into Minneapolis after I graduated with my then fiance, now wife, to be part of the apprenticeship program, which now our Bethlehem Seminary, and went through that. And it was really kind of in that time, I think that there was things present earlier than that in college, but it was in that season that I began to really feel the tension that the book's seeking to address of, you know, we exist to spread a passion for the supremacy of God in all things. And I felt the tension between supremacy of God and all the things. Like, where should my attention be? Where should my focus be? Where should my mind be? And John, in his ministry has kind of made it, he's Johnny One Note, you know, and self-admittedly, he's got one thing he wants to really hammer, and he's going to come back to it again and again in as many ways as possible, which is that truth that God's most glorified and we're most satisfied. But, he does treat the question of how should we then relate to created things. There's a great chapter in When I Don't Desire God where he deals with it. There's some sections in Desiring God where he deals with it and some articles and so forth. But it hasn't been a mainstay, and it's certainly not the dominant note. And so I think a lot of people, basically, and this was true of my life, and then as I talked to others, it became evident, yeah, this is true of anybody who's in kind of our circles. And then as I looked out, I saw other manifestations. So David Platt's Radical would be another kind of there's a family resemblance there. And other groups like that that are trying to push the centrality of Christ, centrality of the gospel, all of life's about God. And then the question immediately becomes, once you sign up, then you look around and you go, well, my family's still here.
Yeah, right.
And am I, you know, so Jesus says, hate them. If you don't hate them, you're not worthy of me. You know, deny yourself, take up your cross. And so you've got all these biblical calls, and then you go, okay, I want to do that. But does that mean that I shouldn't enjoy the tickle fight with my kids? Does that mean I shouldn't enjoy church softball? Does that mean I shouldn't really, really like beer and bacon? You know, so what do I do with these, what I think are non-sinful pleasures, but that really mean a lot to me, that I really enjoy them? They're not just kind of throwaways. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of, so it took, and it was here that I kind of got in really into the writings of, I'd read Lewis before, but Lewis became a close friend. Edwards, especially here, gave me some categories for working through some of this stuff. And then also the fourth influence I'd say that's really prime in the book is Doug Wilson, who I think is probably what sparked it. A couple of years ago, he wrote a series of blog posts interacting with Desiring God. And in those that I just said, yeah, that. What he just said in a little blog post, we need to think more about that. We need to work that out. And then that kind of launched me into a couple of years of really thinking and praying and working through the scriptures and trying to come up with a way of talking about how do we relate God to his world in a way that we really enjoy the stuff and we do so in a way that's not idolatry.
Now, looking back upon your history and biography and that period of your life, do you find that the different authors, Edwards, Lewis, you mentioned also the influence of Doug Wilson there, and of course John Piper through the Passion Conferences and his preaching, do you find that those each hammered something home to you at a different stage in life? Did those figures speak to you in a way that was particularly applicable to each, I don't know, successive stage of your own kind of personal walk or struggle with these issues?
Yeah, I think so. So Piper was first in the sense of, well, I'd read Lewis before I read Piper, but Piper was the first and kind of laid that God-centered, Christ-exalting foundation. He introduced me to Edwards, and I read a little bit of Edwards in college. But so I say that was kind of the, I had my angry Calvinist stage, you know, for about a year.
Oh, sure.
Until God
the cage stage.
And then knocked it out of me. So I had that deal in college and was growing into that. Once I got married, I'd say that's when the tension, especially on questions of the wartime lifestyle, mm-hmm. became really live, because now I have this other person who's committed to the same foundational realities that Jesus is most important, that we want to be wise with our money, we want to be about the kingdom, and yet the way that actually worked out in practice isn't the same. My instincts are not her instincts, and so we had, you know, a number of, you know, I think like a lot of young Christian married couples, a lot of fights about money in that first year,
yeah.
and how we should be using it and whatnot. And so probably in that season of seminary, Edwards became really significant, especially in his Trinitarian theology, which I had, that was kind of my introduction to the centrality of the Trinity to all of life, which I go into in the book. And then probably Wilson somewhere in there is when I started really reading him. And then I'd say marriage and children, that's where Doug's influence really became important. I'd say that most of the things I think about, you know, being a husband and a father are filtered in some way through Doug's influence, whether it's him or his family or whatnot. And so the realness and the potency of those relationships, Doug's really been there. And so then it forced me to then go, okay, how do I relate this deep desire and love I have for my kids to this passion for the glory of God? And then I'd say Lewis has kind of been one of the key thinkers in helping me bridge that gap. He's a big influence on Doug as well. And he kind of, there's a number of places where he just nails it, I think, in getting right this relationship between God and the world.
Of course, and when you talk Piper, we talk Edwards. When we talk Edwards, we can talk a lot of things, but one thing that comes up is, you know, his own influence by Augustine. And when we look at the Trinity, one of your early chapters here is on the glory of the triune God. And you start to introduce different models and analogies about God and helping us to understand the Trinity and how that might apply to God's relation to the world. What are some of the models that you introduce here, and why are they significant for us trying to negotiate the relationship between the glory of the Lord, but yet also what He has made?
Yeah. So the basic insight from Edwards was I had, you know, embraced passion for God, passion for the glory of God, but if God is the triune God, if He's irreducibly three in one, that's just who He is, then we ought to expect that our passion for His glory would be shaped by that, the reality He's a Trinity. And so, and that provided some categories for thinking about. So one of the categories that I bring up, and this has been a discussion recently online as well, I've noticed, is perichoresis, which is the Trinitarian doctrine that the persons of the Godhead mutually indwell each other. So the Father is not the Son, but the Father is in the Son. The Son is not the Father, but the Son is in the Father. And both of them are not the Spirit, but they're in the Spirit, and vice versa. And so this mutual indwelling idea meant that God can be, that the Father can be the Father and yet not cancel out the Son, that it's not a zero-sum game within the Godhead. And even though there, you know, you want to qualify things in terms of moving from the divine register down to the human level, the principle that one thing doesn't have to cancel out another thing in order to be fully itself was kind of a significant one for me. And the other thing that I think Edwards in his Trinitarian theology brought was that in the same way that the Father knows Himself in His Son and loves Himself in the Spirit, which is kind of that Augustinian psychological analogy,
right.
That's mirrored in us, that's what God's doing for us, is He's inviting us into that. So we know, we participate in the knowledge of God, in God's own knowledge of God as it's revealed, and then we participate in the love of God, which is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. And so essentially, God is inviting us into the triune life insofar as creatures are capable of receiving it. So that was kind of the key thing there, because then it opens up a whole world. That's Edwards. That's into which God created the world. That's where that comes from. And so as God invites us in, it opens up this question of, well, how does He make that invitation? where does he invite us into the life of God? Where does he bring us into his Trinitarian fellowship? Well, he does so fundamentally in the scriptures, but then that's what creation is. Creation is that invitation. All of reality is meant to be that invitation to draw us further up, further in, into who God is.
Another metaphor or image that you bring up as God relates to his creation is that God is an author and we are his characters. What light does that shed on this scenario?
These early chapters are some heavy sledding theologically, which is hard when you're writing a book and you're going, some people aren't going to be able to make it, but I felt like this is important. There's some substructure here. But for those who persevere, I hope that that provides some categories. So basically, this is something that a lot of authors, especially contemporary authors, are doing. Nate Wilson uses it. C.S. Lewis does. Tim Keller does. A number of guys. The God-world relation is like the relationship between an author and his stories, or his story, which means that we're essentially characters in God's story. And again, part of the issue here is that analogy is really helpful for me in a whole host of ways. It helps make sense of a lot of Bible passages. And again, it shows how, so think in terms of like sovereignty and human responsibility. The author of a story can ordain everything in the story, and yet every character be fully responsible for his role in the story so that they don't cancel each other out. Again, that's part of what those early chapters are trying to do, is this idea that something can be fully itself and yet not cancel out another thing which is overlapping or with it. So divine causality doesn't cancel out human causality or human action or responsibility. It actually enables it. And in the same way, so that's what the author's story analogy helps me to see, is that who killed the White Witch in Narnia? Mm-hmm. Well, at one level, you say C.S. Lewis did. He wrote the story, so Lewis killed the White Witch, just like Shakespeare killed Hamlet's father. At another level, who killed the White Witch? Well, Aslan did. At the story level, Aslan killed the White Witch. And so those are both true statements. You just have to place them at the proper level. And again, that's just a helpful theological background kind of category to think, okay, so then is there, when you begin to work into the things of earth, is there a way that my pleasure in fish tacos can be fully itself? It can be a real deep pleasure in fish tacos as fish tacos, and yet still be also a delighting in God. Can that happen? Is that possible for those things to not cancel, so that there's not, as you said earlier, this strict opposition where you have to choose? Either you're going to go with God or you're going to go with creation, and those are the options, which is where we end up feeling very stuck.
Right. The question is, can we enjoy God in and through what he has made? And that's sort of right. the point of the next chapter, where you talk about creation as a constant and even pervasive revelation of God. How does creation differ in this conception from what a deist might imagine, for example?
What, a deist?
Yeah.
One way you might actually think about the whole project is trying to elevate and push into the doctrine of general revelation. Mm-hmm. Really robust creational theology is a part of what I'm trying to do. And the heavens declare the glory of God, and I don't think anybody thinks that we're supposed to restrict that to the heavens. The heavens declare the glory of God, and so does everything else. So that we can taste and see that the Lord is good, because we've tasted and seen that honey is good. In fact, one of the passages that's kind of a linchpin for me is in the book of Proverbs, I think chapter 24, where Solomon says, my son, eat honey because it's good, and the drippings of the honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Know that wisdom is such to your soul. And I take that little insight and say, yeah, that's the way everything ought to work. So taste and see that honey is good. One of the reasons honey is good is so that you would have a mental, spiritual, emotional category for knowing what God's wisdom is like. You can't know what God's wisdom is like unless you actually taste honey and savor its sweetness. And the same thing's true of the Bible. You got Psalm 19, which talks about that the scriptures are sweeter than the honeycomb. Well, you can't make that comparison. If you don't think honey's sweet, if you don't care about honey, if you don't care about sweet things, that comparison is meaningless to you. Mm-hmm. And so even when we're trying to do this kind of comparative, God is better than everything, it's dependent upon actually having some kind of real deep pleasure and delight in the created thing that God is better than. And so that's what creation is. So everything declares the glory of God. This is why, for example, Jesus, when he's trying to help us deal with anxiety, doesn't tell us, at least in this passage, doesn't tell us, go read your Bible. He says, consider the birds, consider the lilies. You're anxious. He says, I'm going to point you here's special revelation. So this is Bible. This is word of Jesus, but it's special revelation that's telling you, go look somewhere other than special revelation. Go look at general revelation. Look at God's care for birds. Look at God's care for flowers, and know that because he cares for them, he'll also take care of you. Therefore, don't be anxious about money, and don't be anxious about clothing and so forth. And so the natural world, created world, is filled with what Edwards calls images of divine things. And we're meant to press into them and to consider them using the scriptures essentially like a grammar book. So I'll often tell when I'm talking to students about this, scripture is like the mounts of the world. So a lot of people use Bill Mounce's basics of Greek grammar when I learned in Greek in seminary. Well, the Bible is like the mounts. It's like the grammar textbook for reading the book of nature. And so you go there, that's the authority, that's the thing that sets the rules, that tells you how things are supposed to work and so forth. But it's a key that then you then go out and you say, what's God like? Well, how has he revealed himself in the heavens, in the birds, in rocks and trees and skies and seas? He speaks to me everywhere.
It's fascinating to me to think about how those things relate. And of course, with general revelation, as with all revelation, God is revealing himself to us in a way that we can understand, as Calvin has so aptly described. He lisps to us. Using human language is a condescension for God in the first place, but he also condescends to reveal himself through the things that have been made. And that's not just some sort of inferior revelation either. I mean, even in Romans, Paul describes the fact that even his invisible attributes have been made known, have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And therefore, we can't cast off the things that have been made in some dualistic fashion to think that everything physical is somehow inferior and should be moved to the side. Perhaps it might even be evil in and of itself, and then we should just be ascetic monks who focus all of our time, trying to escape the world and trying to escape our physical trappings so that we can set our minds on the things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father in glory. There, it's not a one or the other. And one way that we know that is even by understanding who we are as creatures. Joe, what does it mean to be a creature in God's world?
This may be, those earlier chapters about God, God's relation to the world and what creation and revelation are important. But I think in some ways, where most of us go wrong is precisely at what it means to be a human being, which is by definition to be finite, to be temporal, to be limited, to be embodied. These are fundamental features of human existence, and they're not problems. And the challenge comes when we, as Christians, set what I think are impossible standards. We basically attempt to be God or to be more spiritual than God. In Lewis's image, he says at one point, there's no use trying to be more spiritual than God. He likes matter. He invented it. So don't try to get away from matter as though you could be more spiritual than God, because you can't be more spiritual. Matter was his idea. He thought infinite wisdom said material world is a good world. And so as creatures, we should embrace the fact that we're limited in the way we are, that we're given bodies, that we live in time, so we can't do everything all at once. We have to experience reality in a sequence of events, unlike God, who's outside of time and so forth. And so embracing these creaturely limitations puts the standard in the right place. Now, putting the standard in the right place doesn't mean everything's good. We still fail even at that, right? So we still fail at being faithful creatures, but it's important that we know we're failing to be faithful creatures. That's where sin comes in, as opposed to we're failing to be the infinite God, which isn't a failing on the part of a creature. God doesn't expect you to enjoy everything all at once. He doesn't expect you to be one of the things I talk about in the book is, are we called to love God infinitely? And if you ask people this, if they're not given a whole lot of thought, a lot of people would say, yeah. Mm. Yeah, we're supposed to love God. God's an infinite being. We should love him in proportion to his value. He's infinitely valuable. Therefore, we should love God infinitely. And what I always try to push back and say, no, you don't do anything infinitely. There's no infinite anything. You're a creature. That's precisely what it means to be a creature, is you don't do things infinitely. And so don't feel guilty because you're not loving God infinitely. Instead, you should feel convicted and you don't love God fully or supremely, which are different, right? So to love God supremely is to put him above everything else. To love him fully is to give him all you've got. But all you've got is creaturely, not infinite. And I think it's a really important thing, because here's the practical payout of really owning our creaturely limits. And I spend a lot of time in the book in the early chapters of Genesis trying to show again and again, God likes these limitations. God approves. They're good. He's not hampered by your finitude. He thinks your finitude is just fine. Embrace it. But the practical payout is, if you continue to think that it's a zero-sum game between God and the world, either you're going to love him or you're going to love the things of this earth, and if you think that your obligation to God is that you must love him infinitely, which means your love for him needs to infinitely surpass your love for your wife and your kids and your food and your church and whatnot, if you think my love for God needs to infinitely surpass it, then what will inevitably happen is you will try to suppress your joy and your love for your children and your wife in the name of holiness.
Right.
And I think that's just a fantastic failure. It's an awful, awful place to be, to feel like my love for God is pulling me away from legitimate love for my family. So that when I'm playing with my kids, if I catch myself really into, building something with them in the backyard, and I'm really having fun, and they're laughing, they're delighting, and this is great. And then this little voice in the back of my head starts to say, but are you loving God right now? Aren't you idolizing your kids? It kills it. It kills the joy in them, and it doesn't make me love God more. It just makes me feel lousy, because I'm failing yet again. And I don't know how to stop. I don't know how to not enjoy. My boys are running around out in the front yard. I don't know how to stop enjoying them. It comes sort of spontaneously. It's just part of being their dad that I just think these kids are great. And so do I have to turn away from my delight in them in order to turn to God, or can I somehow bring them together? That's the fundamental issue.
Right, exactly. As you mentioned, the zero-sum game, it presupposes that you have a certain capacity for enjoyment or a certain capacity for love, whatever that, whatever perspective you want to look at. And if you are increasing your love or your enjoyment in one department, there must be an equal decrease in another department. And
that's right.
And so when you sum up all the gains and losses, you end up with a zero-sum. Just for those who might not be familiar with the term, often used in business, it's very helpful, because it's a category error. What we've done is set up the consideration incorrectly when we start to think through those categories of a zero-sum game, because although we are finite creatures, we don't love and we don't enjoy infinitely, yet our enjoyment of God can be increased and experienced in and through the enjoyment of the things that he's given to us, the things that are good and the things that are noble, the things that do direct our attention ultimately toward him. But yet there's still some fundamental challenges to that vision of gift enjoyment, is the way you put it. What are some of the challenges that we need to address and maybe unravel some of these knots in order to understand more properly how we can get away from the zero-sum game mentality?
Yeah, so part of it is that there is a legitimate place, I think, for that kind of what you might call zero-sum thinking. It does show up in the Bible from time to time, and they're in important ways. And it's basically when it comes to kind of fundamental worship. What's bottom, what's ground, what's fundamental heart affection, what orients you, that question, it is a zero-sum game. It's going to be one thing or another. There's no way to have it be both. Mm-hmm. And so when you read texts like, whom have I in heaven but you, and on earth there is nothing I desire beside you, so there's a place where, you know, you're putting God on one side of the scales and you're putting creation on the other side of the scales, and you're saying, which one's more valuable? So there you are separating them at that point and saying, one of these is going to be ultimate in my affections. Which is it going to be? And as Christians, we know there's only one right answer. You can only put God there. He is better than everything. His love's better than life. Paul in Philippians says, you know, I count everything as loss compared to him, right? So compared to knowing Jesus, everything else in my life, all the benefits, all the good things, they're nothing compared to him. And so I call that in the book, I call that a comparative approach, because that's what you're doing. You're comparing the value, the worth of God to the value and worth of everything he's made. And if you do that, then God wins. If you don't do that, that's called idolatry, right? If you put creature where creator ought to be, that's idolatry. You're not honoring God as God. You're not giving thanks. You're worshiping and serving the creature rather than creator, as Paul says in Romans 1. Then my push in the book is to say, yes, we must do that. We must do that in our songs. We must do that in our preaching. We must do that. We must check ourselves and evaluate ourselves to ensure that God is ultimate. But having done that, having done this separation test where you say, if I could have God and nothing else, is that enough? If I lose everything, if I only have Jesus, is that enough? And you say, yes, that's enough. By the grace of God, that's enough. Then don't leave them separated. Don't leave creation on the other, on one side of scales, and God on the other. Bring them back together. And in the words of Charles Simeon's great little quote, he says, we want to enjoy God in everything and enjoy everything in God. And so bring them back together, and this is what I call in the book integrated enjoyment. And that's what we've been talking about up to this point, which is you don't turn from your family in order to love God. You love God in and through your enjoyment, your delight, your sacrifice for your family. You don't turn from your food in order to enjoy God. You savor the sweetness of the honey as a way of knowing God more fully. And so that's the kind of that comparative versus integrated approach is kind of the heart of what I'm trying to get across, because I think so many Christians live basically integrated lives, and they feel guilty about it because they think they're always supposed to be doing the comparison thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they need to. I think the Bible points us to we have rhythms. So that's part of the book too. There's rhythms in our life where we directly go to God. Our attention is consciously focused on Him. That's prayer. That's scripture reading. That's worship on Sunday morning. Those sort of times where our attention is particularly focused on God. And then I have a category in the book that I call indirect Godwardness, where we haven't turned away from God in an absolute sense. He's still in front of us, but our attention is also now on the things down here that we're supposed to care about, like our jobs, like our families, like our food, like rest, all of the good things that he gives us, and that our lives are meant to be a rhythm, kind of moving back and forth and anchoring ourselves in direct Godwardness, worshiping him, and then going back out into the world and doing all of the other things that God calls us to do in fulfillment of our vocation as his image bearers and as Christians who are trying to bring the gospel to people.
Yeah. Of course, this touches upon the subject of culture and culture making and culture enjoyment. It always comes up. It's always an issue. And we've had our own series on Christ and culture a few years ago. We did a take where we had four different theologians come, and they all got to present their case and cross-examine one another. Just for the sake of the listeners, you can find that. If you go to the website and go under resources, there should be a link for series, and you'll find our Christ and Culture series there. It was held between Bill Dennison, Daryl Hart, Nelson Klosterman, and Doug Wilson, and they all had an interesting interaction with one another about how Christ and culture relate. How can this approach, this integrated approach, help us to be better makers of culture and also enjoyers of culture in a way that honors and glorifies God and therefore also leads to our enjoyment?
Yeah, so in the thing that I try to, what kept coming up as I was teaching through this in preparation for writing the book was that everybody seemed to be okay with the notion that I should enjoy the heavens I said, you know, admiring sunsets is a way of admiring God. Okay, that sounds good. Family, they seem to be okay. Yeah, I want to love my kids. God calls me to love my family, so forth. But inevitably, the question, or even food. Food was one that people, you know, well, there's the verse. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Eat honey because it's good. Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink. So you had Bible verses that were just right there, which made it easy for people to say, okay, I'm with you. Let's enjoy creation, natural things, things that God has made for his sake. The question then came up, what about things that people make? Not things that God makes directly, but things that people make. Does it work the same? And I argue that, yeah, it works exactly the same, I think. So that our enjoyment of culture and our making of culture are the same sort of integrated activities where we anchor ourselves in who God is and what he's done in Jesus. We anchor ourselves in the gospel and in the scriptures. And then we press out to, I remember, it's been a while, but I remember listening to that series. And I'm with Wilson, and I think Klosterman was pretty close to where I remember liking a lot of what he had to say, too. So I'm with the transformationalist types, and we take dominion. We go out and, as faithful Christians, we seek to subdue the earth. We seek to cultivate the earth. We seek to name the world. That's one of the categories I try to bring out in the book, is Adam's naming of his wife as sort of a paradigm of what we're doing in culture making, which the world confronts us just as it is, as God made it. And then his call upon us is he's delegated authority for us to mess with it. To faithfully mess with it, to say, God doesn't tell Adam, here's Eve's name. He says, here, I've done this. I've pulled a woman out of your side, I pulled a rib out of your side, and I built a woman. You give her a name that's fitting and appropriate to what I've done. And that's precisely what Adam does. This at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. She shall be called Isha, because she was taken out of Ish. And so that's culture making. Adam's taking what God has done and he's glorifying it. He's taking it to a new level. And so this is what I think we're called to do as faithful Christians. It's not the only thing, we're called to do. Evangelism and those sort of things are important. But I wouldn't drive a hard and fast wedge between them. And so we're called, in a sense, to, the way I put it in the book is, we're completing creation. We're glorifying creation. And we see this. One of the passages that really helped me to see it was that passage you read earlier about in 1 Timothy, everything created by God is good. Nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving because it's made holy by the word of God in prayer. And so there's this element of God made the world good and even very good, but he's not content to leave it good and very good. He wants it to be hallowed. He wants it to be made holy. And how is it made holy? Well, it's made holy when we receive it with gratitude, and then with governed by the word of God, governed by prayer, we work on it, manipulate it, and draw out these possibilities, these latent possibilities that are embedded within it. And I think this is what we do in science when we discover all the cool things that hydrogen can do, and it's what we do in the arts when we make metaphors and similes and write stories and sing songs that help us to bring out the richness of creation. And so we do that when we make culture, and then we do that when we enjoy culture, when we see other people who've done it well and delight in it.
You mentioned your affinities with transformationalism, or at least some aspects of it. I'm wondering here about some of the other themes here toward the end of your book, where you speak about self-denial and the right attitude toward wealth, but also suffering, pain, and the loss of good gifts. How do we understand those things as well? You know, maybe playing off of the idea of taking dominion, but yet the scriptures also speak to us of suffering and how that's an essential role of the Christian life. Really, our lives are patterned after Christ's suffering so that we also will enjoy and receive his subsequent glories. How do we understand those types of things where we should desire to be with Christ and that includes a Christocentric, Christomorphic pattern of suffering unto glory?
I knew that in writing a book about enjoying things of earth and doing so as a professor at Bethlehem College and Seminary and as a you know, someone who's been very influenced and helped by John Piper, mm-hmm. that I those questions were front and center all the time. So whatever I say here about enjoying creation needs to be compatible with the clear, unmistakable biblical call that, A, you're supposed to voluntarily give up good things in the cause of love, and B, you're going to suffer through many tribulations who enter the kingdom of God. Yeah. So I knew whatever I say about enjoying creation can't just lead in kind of a health, wealth, prosperity direction, which so I was very mindful and aware of that, and think that the health, wealth, prosperity stuff is just abominable, false teaching from the pit of hell. And so, in the book, I lay the foundation of the enjoyment, and then I get to the end and say, okay, now, if you're a faithful Christian, you've got Bible verses that you've been waiting to throw out there, like to deny yourself and take up your cross, go to him outside the camp, suffer with him, joyfully accept the plundering of your property, which is becoming increasingly, that's one of those verses we're going to get to apply, I suspect, in the coming years. Some Christians even today are having to apply joyfully embracing the plundering of their property. So maybe the two things I'd say, there's a couple chapters on this, but the two things I'd say is, first, when it comes to self-denial and sacrifice, we need to sacrifice as faithful Christians and not as, ascetic, monks, Gnostics.
Yeah,
meaning, right. As Lewis again has been really helpful here for me, in Christian self-denial, there's always this respect and admiration for the thing you're giving up, not giving it up because it's a bad thing. You're giving it up precisely because it's a good thing, which means, which is very different than sort of a Greek, you know, sort of a Plato, who Socrates, wanting to give up things because they're bad and they're material and they're earthy. We don't give things up because they're earthy. We give things up because there's something better. God's promised something better, and because we love people, and therefore we want to be strategic in our use of what God supplied. So on the one hand, the text for this that I think is so clear, go read 1 Timothy 6, 17 to 19, because you get it. Paul says, as for the rich in this present age, okay, that's us, rich people, here's what rich people need to hear, charge them not to be haughty or to set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. So there you go, set your hope on God, not on riches. There's that comparative element. But then Paul goes on, set your hope on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. So the God that you set your hope in is also the God who's giving you every good and perfect gift, and you're supposed to enjoy them. But Paul doesn't stop with enjoyment. Health, wealth, prosperity, folks, would stop with enjoyment, right? Paul goes on to say they are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. And so there's this idea that you set your hope on God, he supplies you with everything good, with all these good gifts that you're supposed to enjoy, and then from your enjoyment, it spills over in this generosity and this giving, this richness in good works, as you use what you've received and enjoyed in order to serve other people and advance the kingdom. So that's how voluntary works, and there's more that could be said, but the gifts are given to you for your enjoyment, and they're also given to you as a way of accomplishing the mission that God has of filling the earth with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the water covers the sea. And then maybe the last thing then would be on suffering. This would be kind of the involuntary side. You choose to give up and sacrifice and deny yourself. But what about when you don't choose it? What about when suffering just happens? And I don't know, ironically is not the right word, but fittingly, I suppose, in the midst of writing this book, my father passed away after 7 years of fighting with Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Mm. And so this was kind of front and center, because here's this man that I love, that we were baptized together when I was 12, and you know, he was obviously older, but we were baptized together. He was a good dad. He was a great picture, you know, in terms of general revelation. He showed, you know, this is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. I have emotional categories in my life for the meaning of that because of my dad. I know what it means to be on the receiving end of a happy father because of my dad. And so here's a really good gift in my life, and here it's being ripped out of my hands. This has just been torn away. This is not the plan. That's not what I want to happen. And yet it's the story that God's written for me. And so in the midst of this, we also had some friends who lost a baby, and And so there's all kinds of suffering happening as I'm trying to write a book about enjoying good things. And the thing that the Lord, I think, gave me in wrestling with the scriptures was, in the moment when God is taking away the precious gift, the answer is not to detach and go stoic. The answer is to press into the preciousness, because God has something for you there that you couldn't have any other way. And so it was precisely in recognizing how sweet my dad was for me, how what a sweet fellowship we had, how good it was to know that I'll see him again in heaven, to have that relationship, to press into that pain as he's drifting, his mind's going, to press into the pain and to discover in the midst of that pain that God's there too. And that this too is a picture, that as a father has compassion on his children, so shall the Lord have compassion on you. This is you can't run from it. You've got to press into it, and you shouldn't feel guilty because of how bad it hurts. One of the quote I came across in researching the book, which is just it's so right on, is it hurts just as much as it's worth. And so how much is my dad worth? How much is the baby who dies worth? How much is whatever the precious thing that you lose, how much is it worth? Mm. Well, if you've been, you know, going where I've been going in terms of everything exists as a way of pointing you to God, it's worth a whole lot, which means when it's taken away, it really, really, really hurts. But that pain is where Jesus is going to meet you. He's going to meet you in the depths of that and be for you something that he wouldn't have been able to be had you not felt deeply the enjoyment and the richness of what he'd made. So that's kind of where I kind of actually end the book pretty close to that note of don't run from the pain, press into the pain, and remember, this is where actually I think I end, is you'll get it all back. God never, yes, we lose in this life. We lose everything. And then we get the new heavens, new earth. We get Jesus. We get everything. He's going to graciously give us all things. And so we get new bodies. We get new sights, sounds. We get this earth back. We get our Christian loved ones back. We get everything back. And most importantly, we get him in all of it. And so, when we say goodbye to stuff, we're just saying, see you in a little bit. Which is a great hope, I think. That's why we can rejoice even in our pain. We can grieve as those who have hope and not like the world.
And we see a wonderful picture of that, obviously, with Job and the ending of that story and all of the restoration that occurs, and it even surpasses what he had before. But there's also the promise built into Job of the resurrection, and, of course, that he would see his family members once again and that he himself would be raised imperishable. I really appreciate you finishing the book on that note, Joe, and I think it wraps things up wonderfully. Of course, this world has been touched by and fallen into sin, but yet also God's light still shines. And so I think this is a wonderful book that all of our listeners ought to enjoy. The book itself is a thing of the earth that they can enjoy, and also glorify God by reading and meditating upon the message there. So thanks for joining us today, Joe. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The book, of course, The Things of Earth, Treasuring God by Enjoying His Gifts. It's published by Crossway, brand new title, so you can find copies of this at your favorite bookstore. We encourage you to visit WTSbooks.com. It's a place we love to purchase from, good friends of ours over there, but you can find the book all over the place. And of course, you can get a hold of us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, as well as how to subscribe and get them downloaded automatically to your computer or smartphone or listening device, whatever it may be. You can also get a hold of us at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can tweet us at Reformed Forum. And one final thing, we want you to sign up for the conference, reformedforum.org/conference. All the information about travel and times and all that is online, October 16th through 18th, just north of Chicago, just outside of O'Hare Airport, not too hard to get here. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.